You know, we in Madison are really blessed to have terrific bakeries. I recently spoke to someone from Wausau who lamented the state of their bakery. You know, and it's true of many places. So in a world of ultra-processed food, our youngest daughter said, you know, there's really not a loaf of bread I'd rather purchase in the world than country sourdough. She also said, and I saw a joke about this a couple of years ago, there was a tech bro in San Francisco who looked at his spending, and it turned out 40% of his monthly spending was at Tartine, a very well-known bakery in San Francisco. And Kate, our youngest, who is a serious foodie, said, Dad, Madison sourdough is better than Tartine. So there you are.
Major leagues.
Exactly. And they have survived the pandemic and really thrived. So, you know, if we have friends in town, you can always rely on Madison sourdough for having a great high quality product consistently, which is not easy at 3 a.m. every day. So with that, Drew's on stage and then Ronnie's going to offer some comments after. So Drew, the floor is yours. And he's sitting because he stands all day. So.
Yeah. Thank you, Jim. I have been standing a lot over the weekend, so I'm going to sit, which is really nice. Thank you for having me. I'm not used to public speaking, and so I'm going to mostly read something I wrote. And what I'd like to do is, you know, this is maybe slightly uncomfortable for me because it's talking about something that I do every day. I've been doing it for 2 decades now, but trying to just offer you a little glimpse inside what I'm kind of doing in the morning and what I'm thinking about. So this is, or like title this, what I think about when I think about bread. So just kind of a, offer you a little insight into, you know, where my passion is. So, first thing I think about before in the day in the bakery is weather, the weather. And for me and every other artisan baker, the weather has an impact on our bread. Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it dry? Is it wet? These are my primary concerns. And what was the weather like yesterday? What is it predicted for tomorrow? These are the questions that I ask myself to inform the many small decisions I would make in the bread of the morning. My task is to produce what is seemingly the same bread day after day with changing environmental conditions. This begins with my ritual 2-mile bike ride to the bakery at 2:30 in the morning. I need that every day. It's really, really nice. I like it on the way home too. It's just a way to just sort of decompress. And yes, I bike all year long. It's close enough I can manage it. The breeze, the coolness or warmth of the air, how thick the air feels. These are all the elements I soak up as I prepare my body and my mind to wake up and focus on the tasks of the day. My arrival at the bakery is a moment of anticipation. I love walking into my bakery, seeing the place clean from the night before, ready for a new day of work. A clean slate. I put myself together, grab an apron, and pull myself a couple shots of espresso in the cafe. My eyes often wander to the outside, looking through the front window on a quiet pre-dawn morning. It's kind of bittersweet for me. It's often around bar time, people ending their day just as I begin mine. And my mind often wanders to, you know, a social life I might be missing, the one I didn't really even have in my 20s. I started baking when I was 22 and was up early in the morning. But then I think about how much I dislike being at bars, especially late at night. And then I think mostly about every other baker who is likely doing nearly exactly what I am doing at this moment. I think about bakers throughout history, reaching back to ancient Egypt, ancient Rome, pre-World War II France, post-war Europe. And I take solace and comfort in being part of that tradition, part of a historical continuum of artisans in the night. And I also contemplate my role in mentoring future bakers for tomorrow. to be fair, the toils of the bakery have vastly improved from the past. Just in the past 100 years, the life of a baker is much, much better. We have machines to help mix our doughs. We have modern ovens, air conditioning, refrigeration. Many advances in technology within the bakery were spurned by two things. One, to bring better consistency and higher volume to meet demand. And two, to make the baker's work less strenuous and more restful. It is still physical labor, but far better than in the past. As an example, wood-fired ovens, which, you know, is how people bake bread for many, many thousands of years, require consistent and planned firing, while a modern gas oven calls for heat as it's needed. They produce similar results, but modern ovens are much more consistent and predictable. And another example is the common practice of using baker's yeast to leaven bread. Baker's yeast was not commercially sold until the mid-1800s. And before that, all bread was naturally leavened with sourdough starter. Similar to a wood-fired oven, sourdough starters require disciplined maintenance and care in order to produce quality bread day after day. And it was a continual struggle for bakers of the past to define their lives around the feeding of their starters and the fermentation of their bread doughs. It was very demanding, you know, on for three, you know, you have to feed a starter and go sleep for 3 hours and then feed it again and do all these things. Advances in temperature control have offered bakers the ability to manipulate fermentation to better fit a balanced lifestyle. Balancing work and life is a perennial problem for myself and probably most people in this room. For bakers, especially those of the past, their desire to live a better life often motivated the adoption of technology that gave them better control over a demanding schedule of bread. These advances have been taken to some extremes at the expense of bread itself. Bland, insipid, unremarkable vehicles for other flavors. Bread has, since the world wars and industrialization, suffered the sad effects of habit, indifference, overfamiliarity, and neglect. But the modern artisan baker today, myself included, have chosen to recreate and expand on the breads of our past. We use technology as tools to produce the best bread, not to make it more simple, but to reach back to its past complexity with certain levels of control that maybe they didn't have then. And yet, even with the controls afforded us by technology, bread is a constant reminder of the chaos from which we arose. Modern artisan bakers often lean into the unpredictable. We use fresh milled flour, natural leavening that harnesses wild yeast and bacteria alone to raise our bread. We don't use baker's yeast. And in some cases, people are still using wood-fired ovens by choice to bake these loaves. To quote from a wonderful book called The Book of Bread by Jerome Assayer, it's a Frenchman, he says, "The masters of the craft confront the unpredictable with a sense of exultation." And I just felt like that was just a great quote where, you know, we just want to just rush and try to, you know, create something excellent with, you know, sort of, how should I put it? Like, you know, something that's unpredictable. So, and it is in this exultant moment of anticipation that I start my day. The first thing I do is check that my ovens have fired to the correct temperature. I then take an expectant peek at the various pre-ferments prepared the afternoon prior. The pouliche should look on the verge of producing a wild foam, visually similar to a bubble bath at its peak volume, on the verge of collapse. I look for what I call the rivers, small valleys that run through the surface of the pouliche, reminiscent of an aerial view of a river and its many tributaries. The aroma is that of white wine and almonds and blonde ale. My favorite is to peek at the sourdough starter, or what people call the natural levain. You visually, I can see the slow percolation of fermentation gases escaping through the top. The smell is redolent of green apples, bananas, fresh cut hay, and hazelnuts. The taste is a punch of sour lactic and acetic acid, and followed with the last holdouts of sugars that have a very honey-like aroma. I always taste our sourdough starter. It speaks to me. Many years ago, I was working with Philippe Martin, a French baker in Paris, and he showed me his levain. I pinched off a bit of it, stuck it in my mouth, and said, And he looked at me and he just said, "What are you doing? Don't eat it." he said, "Just smell it." And I was like, "Okay." But I still taste it. I still get a lot out of that. I love to taste it. I love the aromas too, but the taste acts as a kind of pH meter and like a Rick's refractometer. I can taste the sour and the sweetness, and it gives me a read on our sourdough starter on a daily basis. It tells me what is the starter is the parent from which all of our loaves from this day will be born. They carry a lineage of yeast and bacteria and all the byproducts of fermentation. The bread is only as good as the sourdough starter is. You cannot hide it. It's that simple. If that sourdough starter is bubbling with life, the bread will too. Over the years, I have developed a relationship with my starter. I don't anthropomorphize the starter, and I don't name it. Everyone asks me, "What's the name of your starter?" But we work together. Right. For me, it's a symbiotic relationship. In essence, I feed and provide an environment through a mixture of wheat flour and water that allows the desired wild yeast and bacteria to thrive in a vibrant microbial community. And it's through my care and disciplined feeding schedule that allows the sourdough starter to thrive. And in turn, this microbial family leavens my bread. Through fermentation, they transform small grains, mostly wheat, that are otherwise not nutritious and hardly digestible, into a sort of culinary wonder that is light, airy, delicious, and most importantly, nutritious. In bread, I view myself, the baker, as the medium through which wheat achieves the fullest expression of itself. Wheat is in a state of becoming, and I am the vector for its transformation. It's no wonder that bread has become a symbol of nature, health, and life itself. There's something so wondrous and mystical about the transformation of the seed head of a mutant grass into a loaf of bread that is often described as a kind of birth. It's also no wonder that bread is so often shown in Christian stories, iconography, and religious paintings. It has achieved a sort of hallowed aura, especially before we could actually understand what was happening biologically or chemically. It used to be a sort of beautiful mystery, and in some ways it still is. The baking day for us at Madison Sourdough has the beginning of bread and the end of bread. We mix doughs that are handled, shaped, and allowed to proof and ferment until the following morning. And at the same time, we are also baking the breads that were mixed, formed, and fermented from the day prior. Mixing our bread doughs is deceptively simple. Most of our breads are simply flour, water, salt, and the starter or the levain. The process is also really simple. Add water, leavening, and flours to the mixer. Mix it until it's all incorporated. Let it rest. Add salt, finish mixing it for 5 minutes. We use formulas and percentages and amounts weighed to the gram, temperature controlled water, machines that don't deviate, and yet the doughs are different day to day. This is what makes artisan baking so interesting. Fresh flour, natural leavening combined with weather changes are constantly variable. But we can react, and when I begin a mix, I first note the texture of the sourdough starter itself. As I disrupt the delicate web of gluten trapped carbon dioxide gas, it's stringy and it's webbed. It's on the verge of collapse, but still it handles easily. And when we place, when it's placed in the mixer with water, I want to see it literally float on top of the surface because it's basically holding a bunch of gas. This is what we call like kind of an indication that the starter is ripe or ready for use. After I add the flour and start the mixer, I observe the mix and note how quickly the water is being absorbed. I find a variation in what we would say the run of the mill. So the term kind of comes from millers, who was like, bakers would receive flour from a miller, and it would be like different each time. And they say, oh, it's just the run of the mill, right? It's just like you just accept what it is. And we mill flour at our bakery, and there's variation. Who did the milling? There's a lot of variables that could happen. So sometimes the water seems to absorb differently. Sometimes it sits on top. Sometimes it's drier, minimally, fractionally. I use a scraper to clean the sides of the mixing bowl, and I plunge my arm elbow deep into the dough, scouring for spots, dry spots at the bottom. This gives me the best indication of how well the flour is absorbing the water. And these are just some notes that I make as I proceed with the mixes of the day. The magic happens with the autolyse or rest period. It gives the dough time to stabilize, fully hydrate, and the gluten strands begin to align completely. After adding salt, we finish the mix, and within 1 minute, I can get a good sense of the strength of the dough. Will it be slack or elastic? Does it look wet or dry? And at this point, I start another mix. We use three mixers at a time, and I perform a kind of dance between them. I talk a lot about rhythm with my bakers. Baking is about moving in time with the rest of the elements of the bakery, neither too fast or too slow. Sometimes we speed up. Sometimes we're in a more relaxed tempo. Mixing dough should never feel rushed. It's not a time to be lazy, though. In fact, over the years of training bakers, I found most success describing the tempo and rhythm of mixing multiple doughs for a three-hour period through visual diagrams as opposed to instructions, like mix this at 3 o'clock, mix this at 3:15. That doesn't usually work. It's more, you have to kind of feel it. So we can't really be programmatic. We need to be more fluid and in rhythm with the tempo set for the day. My first true indication of how a dough will be is when I begin folding it. It is a moment during the first fermentation where I stretch and fold the dough, further aligning gluten strands and providing a gentle strengthening to the dough. An immature baker views folding as a thing you just do to the dough, a task to be formed in the process prescribed by me. For me, it's a little more intimate. I am sometimes called the dough doctor at the bakery. The dough presents evidence to me. It's showing me what it may become. Stretch and folds are my first kind of touch of the dough during fermentation. I adapt how many folds I perform, how aggressively I choose to do them, and generally get a sense of how the dough is developed for the first couple hours of its life. And by the last stretch and fold, the dough should feel silky, inflated, buoyant. And I want to see gluten strands stretching in one kind of cascading weave. Layers of silk fabric ready to trap and hold gas, producing a light and airy loaf of bread. It's still a wonder to me that it works at all, but it does. After the dough has its first few hours of fermentation, the general structure of the dough has been set for mixing, folding, fermenting. It's ready to be divided into pieces and shaped into loaves. Large bakeries, they use machinery to cut bulk pieces of dough, and we use a tool like that for some types of bread. But the majority of our breads are hand-scaled piece by piece and then pre-shaped into a round loaf, rested, and shaped again into a round or oblong loaf. Scaling and shaping is really a sensual process. For me, it's just an extension of the mixing and the folding, only we are giving the dough its final touch and setting the loaf up for it to stand tall in the oven. Immature bakers, and even some who have baked for a long time, simply make what I say, call it dough balls, right? just make doughs. Moved and handled like an object and processed to a certain specification. For me, it's like handling a newborn each time. I remember when my first daughter was born, the doctor came in and was kind of checking her out. And he just grabbed her by her two feet and lifted her up like a chicken. And he scoped her out and then asked me to change her diaper. And this was all new to me, and I was really nervous, and it was awkward to say the least. I didn't know how to handle this foreign being. Too gentle, too firm, not knowing where to use pressure. But as I learned and recalled seeing the doctor handle her, it was firm but gentle, confident, swift. It's very efficient. Shaping dough is a kind of paradox for me. You need to handle the dough very firmly, but not so much that it's sticking to your hands. It should feel soft and supple, like a baby's bottom. My favorite quote for new bakers is, handle the dough with an iron hand in a velvet glove. Firm but soft. When I shape, I move the dough into its natural form. I don't force it. I hate fighting it. I need to give it time, give it love. The best indicator for a baker's skill at the shaping table is how much dough is on their hands. And ideally none. If you're covered in dough, the loaf is tearing and it's still going to be bread, but the shaping is somehow taking something away. We proof our breads after shaping in a cold environment at 52 degrees. It's too warm to be a cooler, but cold enough to slow the proofing and fermentation. For me, this is like putting, you know, a baby to sleep. They're safe, they're content, dreaming and becoming, ready for the next day. They're transforming with the slow percolation of yeast and bacteria, eating sugar and releasing carbon dioxide, organic acids, alcohol. The retarder always makes me think of a cave. So this environment is more like a cave temperature. It is the same constant temperature, and it is optimal for slow, controlled fermentation. Think like beer or wine or cider or lactic fermentation, cheese. These are timeless ferments for preservation, and bread is part of that tradition. Baking bread is probably, like, the bakery bread is probably my favorite part of the bakery. It is magical and romantic in ways that connect me to the past, while pulling me right back to the present moment, because I can't be somewhere else, right? I love to peek at the loaves in the morning before they go in the oven and assess every kind of bread. Underproof, overproof, dry, wet, damp, are they just right? Our typical lineup of bread, they generally falls within the parameters of, yeah, it's all ready to bake, so start doing it. But when I work with a new bread, I'm thinking about it when I wake up. When I open the retarder to see how they turn out, it's kind of like Christmas morning. Surprise, joy, and maybe some disappointment sprinkled in there. I still am surprised by successes, often more than my failures. When I score the bread, which is where you cut the top of the loaf before going in the oven, it tells me how much tension is left in the dough. And tension is built from the mixing and the shaping. It's maintained to a point during the proof, but it begins to decline at some point. And to a certain degree, we are trying to catch a wave, kind of like surfing or body surfing. When you catch the optimal point, you absolutely know it, because the wave will rip you towards shore. When scoring, the loaf breaks open, rips apart, exposing the interior. The loaf should stand tall. Sometimes it deflates. When I load them in the oven, provide a little steam to help the loaf expand and create a nice crust. And after a few minutes, I usually can't help but peek at how well they have risen. It's still magic to me, like seeing water stand up. I usually set timers so I don't burn the bread, but I really don't need them. I have a refined sense of time, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I can really feel that. But I also use my nose when baking. I can smell when they are ready. The aroma is sweet, sour, and slightly acrid. The crust caramelizes like the burnt edges of toast. complex aromas of fresh wheat, milk, almonds, fresh cut hay, and sour apples. I also love the sounds of the bakery, especially when I'm baking. Wooden peels on the stone surface, slowly sanding its way towards the perfect bevel. As I remove the loaves, the crusts rubbing each other into a beautiful crackle. And once all the loaves are removed from the oven, they begin cooling. For the first 10 minutes, they sing to me. Crusts crackling like dry kindling in the night as the loaves contract in the cool, dry air. I squeeze the bread and listen to the symphony of crackle. You ever seen Ratatouille? There's a really nice little line from a poem by Arthur Rimbaud. He writes, "And when, as midnight sounds, shaped crackling and yellow, the bread is taken out, when beneath smoke-clad beams, scented crusts sing, and the crickets." Bakeries are social centers, a place for regulars to gather, punctuating their day or week as people plan the bakery experience in their daily lives. I love sharing this passage from Jacques Pepin's memoir, My Life in the Kitchen. I don't know if anyone has read this. I highly recommend it. I'm just going to read a quick little passage here. So the kind of backdrop to this is Jacques Pepin is a young boy in France. He's got a brother and his mom and dad. His dad is off to war in World War II. And they live just outside Lyon. And for the summer, him and his brother are sent away to live on a farm. When they get there, they realize that they're both going to be living on separate farms. And so it's really sad about this. And he's kind of lamenting it in the whole first chapter. So obviously very sad. His dad's at war. He's away from his mom. He's away from his brother. And so I'll start now. His brother's name is Roland. So bread baking day had all the excitement of a carnival. Villagers greeted each other loudly and gossiped in small clusters. Kids ran about and played. I was standing forlornly on the outskirts when Roland appeared. He was staying with a family in Mont-Brunel, which meant that I would not only see him on baking days, but on Sundays as well, since the villages also shared a single church. Mont-Vernier and Mont-Brunel were so close together that we could even walk to visit each other during the week when our farm duties permitted. The oven seemed as large as a house, and together, Roland and I watched the baker farmer feed it with the pile of wood needed to bring it to the proper temperature. So they're all gathering in a communal wood-fired oven that's shared between these villages. And we stood there for hours, one after the other. Farmer arrived with their loaves, two dozen or so each, and the baker would take over. At the end of the day, some farmers brought casserole dishes containing anything from beans to cabbage to be cooked overnight in the heat, retained by the oven. Back at the farm, Madame Mercier arranged her loaves like decorative plates on the high, narrow shelves running along two entire walls of the room. Every night for dinner, she brought down a new loaf. Seated at the head of the table, Monsieur Mercier held the loaf on its edge and marked a cross on its underside with his folding wood-handled knife. This was intended as a sign of respect for the bread and an offering to God, although it was more a ritual food than a religious observance. Only then would he cut the bread into large chunks and distribute it around the table. Mont-Vernier offered plenty of experiences for a young city boy. The glorious peaks of the Alps, the frightening chasms bordering the narrow mountain roads, the powerful and intoxicating smell of the summer hay that we spent hours cutting and gathering, the hair-raising rides perched on bales of hay in a cart pulled by a donkey that occasionally slipped as he headed down treacherous paths on his way to the barn. But for me, the most impressive thing about the Alps was that wood-fired bread oven, and the way it not only nourished, but also brought together the people of two remote mountain communities. And I will end my talk with a haiku I wrote. Roots sown and grown deep through hands and heat, things unseen, shared and broken past.
All right. Thank you, Drew.
Monty, why don't you come up and give your response, and then we'll have questions after that. Grab some water, Drew.
What shall I say?
So you could. You want to sit here? Do you want to sit or stay? Let me give you the chair. You guys can sit. Yeah.
I'm happy to sit. Okay.
Good.
So I thought I'd just tell you, first of all, I'm an acolyte. that I woke up this morning at 8, and I went downstairs and I got my bread out of the refrigerator, and I heated the oven to 500, and then I realized I didn't have enough time to bake my bread because I had 2 Tai Chi classes. So I came back after my second Tai Chi class and turned the oven back on to 500 and put my 4 rolls together, because that's how I decided to do them, which was a combination of sourdough starter from Madison Sourdough that I had been taking care of for about 5 years, thanks to Drew. And a little bit of rye flour and a little bit of white flour and a little bit of whole wheat flour. And the white flour came from King Arthur because it's cheaper, but it's not garden variety run of the mill white flour. And it's fine. And so, you know, I flipped it from my basket onto the top part of the Dutch oven that Drew told me to go and buy at the Ace Hardware store on Williamson Street. And I scored it. I went da-da-da-da-da and da-da-da-da-da with, you know, my special razor blade that's just like yours. And the other 2 loaves, I went da-da-da-da, yeah, the other way. Anyway, baked it for 20 minutes, and then I took the lid off, and then I baked it for another 10 minutes, because I find that with my oven, doing more than that is too much. So the only time in my life when I baked was as a breakfast baker in Madison, when I had to get up at 2:30 in the morning and I would take the car because it wasn't very far. And it was a very lonely experience for me because I was a woman alone in a bakery, and I was petrified. I was just petrified that somebody was going to break into the bakery. So my experience baking, even though I loved it for some of the same reasons, but with basically pies and rolls and muffins and scones, was very different from yours. I loved the smell of the bakery. And that was the only reason why I continued to go there at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I found ways to do my prep so that I could show up at 4 instead of 3. So that is a kind of background, just to say that I am an amateur baker. I am not a professional. But I am the child of European parents, which matters because we had in New York City, around the corner from our house, a German bakery where I would go and be sent by my parents to pick up a German rye. And my mother was English and brought up on whole wheat bread. And so I, as an American, wanted to eat Tip Top and Bond bread and Silver Cup. But I think we were allowed to have that maybe a couple of times. And it was so wonderful. You could just squeeze it in the plastic bag. And my sister and I cut out little round ones and pretended that they were holy wafers, even though my mother was an atheist and my father was a Jew. But okay. So, and we also had an Austrian pastry maker who was at between 95th and 94th Street and 3rd Avenue. And he made the most wonderful cream cakes where you were the only people who know this story apart from the intimate members of my family. I didn't like my name, and so I had him write, "Happy birthday, Tammy." All right, that's enough of that. So I was also the product of a French education, which is why for me, bread is always French bread, unless it's American and unless it's Madison sourdough. And I've said this to you, so you know that this is true, that Madison sourdough makes the best croissant east of the Mississippi and west as well. I really think that you make the best croissant, and your miche is, and your baguette, of course, but it's the miche and baguette that I favor is better than many breads that I have tasted in New York, and I have made pilgrimages around the city to taste different kinds of French bread, and also in Burgundy. And for me, what the wonder of miche is that it's a bread like many of the artisan breads in France that were made in the 18th century, in the 19th century. It was a bread that had to last. It was a bread that, if it started to get stale, would be incorporated into soup. It was not something that you threw away ever. It was a source of important nourishment. And the wonder, you know, I mean, people think baguettes go dry, and they do, but the miche is something that can last a whole week, and is something that you hold in your hand and you score it, you cut it towards you. You should probably cut it away from you, but I always found that very poignant. That the head of household would run the knife towards him. So that's a little bit in the beginning of me. In the beginning, bread for me is universal. You see wheat being used across the world, or things that can be used to also make bread. I'll keep my, so for me, bread is universal. And it's something that I think all peoples can understand and relate to and value. And for me, it's French bread, which is the center of the universe. It's the mainstay of the French diet historically. It was a significant portion of caloric intake, especially among the poor. In the 18th century, it was 900 grams versus 130 grams today. It's been a major player at every juncture in history. It's been a guarantor of social stability. In 2022, UNESCO added the, quote, artisanal know-how and culture of the baguette bread to the UN's list of, quote, intangible cultural heritage, which it defines as, quote, traditions or living expressions inherited from our ancestors and passed on to our descendants that should be safeguarded. Some of you may know that there was a revolution in French bread. The rich liked white bread. The poor could not afford white bread. In the 1950s, the quality of French bread declined, with some of the things that Drew mentioned: the introduction of mechanization, time and labor saving techniques, the use of industrial yeast and additives. There was a decline of sourdough fermentations based on the starter culture, a loss of skill, a loss of bread's taste. And then the French said, "My God, what are we doing? We can't eat this stuff." And so a new generation of bakers emerged with a mission to revive artisanal baking, and among them was Lionel Poilon. And this revolution and interest spread to the U.S., And I believe Andrew Hutchison is not only part of a centuries-old tradition and history, but he is also part of Poilane's revolution. So what is a baker? A baker is a poet, and the fact that you had a haiku is just really terrific. And a baker is a craftsman. And what Drew has done today, for me at any rate, is to redefine bread making. It's both something physical, but it's also something spiritual. The physical part is not necessarily what we expect it to be. It's something where the baker's body is entirely engaged, looking, smelling, touching, feeling, standing, bending, arching, even, as he said, dancing. And the spiritual part is that the baker's soul and mind, the mind's intelligence, is engaged in work that provides challenge, but also meaning, redemption, connection, a sense of purpose and well-being, even love. Because how could it not be? A sourdough starter is a living thing. And nothing less than poetry. It's an activity that doesn't tire for Drew. It's a job he clearly enjoys, goes to willingly, returns from satisfied. Not just a job, but a life. And how many of us can say that about the work that we do? I also think that what he's described is the baker as artist, teacher, and muse. The baker is someone who stands in for nature, nutrition, and health. The baker is a nurturer, a father, mother, lover. The baker is a mainstay, a pillar of the community, someone who is indispensable. The baker is an icon, the one who carries on tradition and history, and the baker as an activist and revolutionary. And get to the activist and revolutionary. The baker is also a symbol of stability in unstable times. So as Drew mentioned, the baker lives with the unknown weather, depending on heat, cold, humidity. The baker adapts the process, taking her or his cue from the dough itself. But the baker lives with chaos in a different way. And I wanted to remind us of Gaza and the food lines in other parts of the world, where the bakery is as important as a hospital or home. It's not exactly what Drew means when he says or quotes, the masters of the craft confront the unpredictable with a sense of exaltation. And I wish for all of us that we live in more peaceful times. But bread making is as vital, necessary, charitable, even holy in times of scarcity, hunger, and grief. But he also makes the baker seem too good to be true. The physical challenge to the body, the burns, the cuts, the bruises, the sprains, the perils associated with big mixing machines and hot ovens. Occupational hazards include rhinitis, which is an irritation to the nose, contact dermatitis, and baker's asthma from being around flour dust. It's one of the most common occupational respiratory illnesses, and he also did not mention disrupted sleep patterns. like going to bed at 8 o'clock at night or something like that. He didn't talk about the challenges of running a baking business. The fact that he's been in business for as long as he has and continues to love it is, I think, quite remarkable. So what does he deal with? Product shelf life management, food allergen management, supply chain delays, labor shortages, seasonal fluctuations in demand, rising operating costs, competition. In France, for instance, there's the hypermarket and the supermarket, and they're apparently doing, for some people, good bread. In America, according to the Retail Bakers of America, 40 years ago, there were 30,000 bakeries in the United States. Today, there are just 6,000.
Yeah.
If you want to know my sources, I can tell you. So, where do we go from here? What are some of the questions that I want to leave you with? I forgot this one. The baker is Miller. And I left over there an article in the Capital Times, if any of you have not read it, by Lindsay Christians. There's been a recent emergence of mills in Wisconsin after a history of decline, and she talks about it in her article, and I was thrilled to see it. There is a small group of farmers, millers, and bakers who are, quote, pushing back against the dominance of industrialized corn and soy. Before Wisconsin became the dairy state, it was known for its wheat. In 2016, Drew installed a mill, and he was quoted as saying, the quality of the grains has to get better. Madison Sourdough's website says that 40% of the flour used by the bakery is milled in-house. But he also says, but to have something that's consistent, meets customer expectations, I'm cutting it with high-quality commercial flour. But you can buy his milled flour if you want to work with it, and I have. I just can't afford it. I can't afford your bread. So looking over my notes, where do we go from here? Know your bakers. Know your local bakers. Taste your bread. Be discriminating. Be prepared to pay more for a good loaf. Learn how to bake bread, even though it may not be very good. It's just, it really is it's a wonderful moment, or a series of moments, or a special time. I love touching my bread. I love watching the little bubbles appear. And it is as soft as a baby's bottom. And to learn to love your baker as yourself. because you are what you eat, and therefore you are what Drew and his crew are preparing for you. You do have, through your body, an intimate connection to what comes out of the bakery. And I thought that I'd just quote with something that Libération, the French left of center daily, once said, bakeries set the pace of our lives. Bakeries and their products are reassuring elements that guarantee the survival of a world of human contact, of proximity, of simple and affordable quality. In short, of everything that is in danger of disappearing.
Thank you.
All right.
Questions?
Oh. Just, I guess, in support of your artistry, we're musicians, and I know that humidity and the place you play, the room and everything where you do your music changes constantly. And a truly good musician is somebody who recognizes what they want to see come out the end, and you adapt constantly. So your whole conversation about weather and smell and texture was very, very favorite. If I could ask you a question about your poolish, not to steal your recipe.
Yeah.
You start with your sourdough starter when you do your poolish?
Sorry, what is poolish?
Oh, okay, yeah, sorry.
That's your question.
Poolish is a mixture of flour and water. And a little bit of baker's yeast, so not just So it's what we would describe as a type of pre-ferment. So basically, taking some of the flour and fermenting it ahead of time, so it develops a little bit more character to then be mixed into a bread dough. And a poolish is just pretty much defined that it's equal parts flour and water. So it's almost the consistency of pancake batter, but then it's a pancake batter that rises, it'll triple in volume, and it gets extremely kind of bubbly.
Mine doesn't quite get bubbly, but you know, I have a house that's like 68 degrees,
yeah,
I give it 14 hours and it's got little bubbles, but never did.
Yeah,
what you said. Yeah, well, thank you.
When you say you're preparing your first batch of dough, and it may not be quite right, how do you correct it? What do you?
I mean, I more if it's a small difference, you know, that's something I can correct throughout the process. As long as I know I have the correct measurement of ingredients, I think that this variations in flour, I can, you know, I could add a little water, I could add a little flour to it, especially in the early stages, but more or less I'm gonna adapt more of like, okay, I'm gonna maybe when we do like folding on the dough, I'll do that a little bit more aggressively or more gently, depending. But you know, we do. I tell bakers that work at Madison Sour that when mistakes happen, or I added twice as much water to this, what do I do? It's taken years for me, but I very rarely have to scrap thing. And I think learning how to make those corrections is a great challenge. And it just, I tell people sometimes that I'm like a fireman, like I've almost kind of like a kind of crave emergency in some ways, you know, like, you know, I don't really like doing it, but it kind of turns me on a little bit to be like, okay, this is a challenge. I want to meet it, you know? So there's a lot of ways you can correct it. You know, oftentimes people add too much water or not enough water. And so the whole mixture, the whole matrix seems to be kind of manipulated, but most things are fixable. Yeah.
Okay. Could you give us me a sense of the scale of your operation, maybe the history, how much you produce?
Yeah. So we bake, somewhere between 600 and close to 2,000 loaves of bread on a daily basis. You know, I would say 2,000 would be like absolute, that's absolute maximum. Yeah. It just involves all the varieties of bread, the baguettes and the whole thing. Let's see here. So, what was the other part of that question?
I had history. I mean, most of it started small.
Yeah. So Madison Sourdough actually started in 1994. It was started by Cam Ramsey and his wife, BJ. And they actually opened a small shop on Williamson Street, just a little further east from where we're located. And after a couple of years, they quickly outgrew that space. They moved out to Middleton, out to the Middleton Business Park, and they sell two large ovens. They're selling a lot of bread to grocery stores. Somewhere around 1999, you know, the Atkins diet was a big thing. And, you know, we talked about the physicality of the work. Cam, I love him, but could not delegate work. So he completely burned it. He said, he told me that one day him and BJ, his wife at the time, they looked at each other and they said, what are you thinking about? And she said, thinking about closing. He said, me too. And he said, then we just did it. So then they closed, kind of took a sabbatical for a few years and reopened in 2003 on Mineral Point Road. And they wanted to open a cafe, bakery cafe. Something small, not do wholesale. Because when you start selling to, you start wholesaling to restaurants and grocery stores, I describe it as it's an endless demand for what you're making. And so it just becomes, you make bread, you know, 355 days of the year, right? So it's very demanding in that sense. And so anyways, they wanted to get out of that, but their location, a variety of things, maybe the wrong time, not the right synergy of the place. After a few years, they started wholesaling again because they just needed to make ends meet. That's about the time I started working for them. I started working for them in 2006. It was completely by chance that I started working there. I had recently graduated from UW with a degree in fine arts. And that was kind of, I was looking for work over the summer. And I was hoping to get into fine cabinetry. And I had kind of a line to work with a guy. And it kind of fell through. And I kind of, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I need, you know, I got to pay my rent next month or whatever. And so I had my previous work experience was in high school. I started working in a kitchen when I was 15. And then when I graduated from high school, the summer between high school and college, I worked at a Great Harvest bakery. It was like kind of a franchise bakery. And, you know, I was 18. I was getting up at 3 a.m. I was going in and bread and cookies and stuff like that. And it's not like I, you know, I look back and I'm like, oh, I loved that bread at the time. I probably wouldn't be eating it now just because I'm more discerning. But I was looking for a Great Harvest that used to be in Madison. And I drove out to the west side. And this is before having like a Google Maps and all that stuff. I could not find it and because it had closed.
Right.
And I drove by Madison Sourdough. And I was like, I kind of did a U-turn. I was like, oh, let's see what's up, you know? And so I stopped in. They said they needed help. And I talked to Cam and he said, yeah, why don't you come in tomorrow for an interview at 5 a.m. Okay. So I did that. And one more layer to the story was that I like telling people that I was fired on my first day. And so I got the job and I came in and the first day I was starting at 3 a.m. I arrived at 3:04 a.m. And he was in there baking bread. He opened up the door and then he said, this isn't going to work. And so why? He said, you're late. I said, well, I won't be late again. He goes, I got a rule. In the first week, I'm not going to bother. I said, well, I really want to help, you know? So I just came back the next morning and I got there before him. And I and he looked at me, he smiled. He goes, I'll see you tomorrow morning. So anyways, so I for him until 2009, and then he was just going through some life changes and was just kind of ready to get out of the business. A baker that I had been training was another older gentleman who had a background in finance and had an MBA, and so I was 26 years old and I was not ready to run a business at all, but I was definitely ready to be the person behind the operation. So I partnered with David Lorenz and we ran Madison Sourdough. We moved to our current location. We opened that in April of 2010. So August 2009, purchased the business, moved it in April of 2010, which again was, there's more story there. And we just kind of went all in, just put all of our chips into the pile and just, hopefully this works. And it's been really great organic growth over the last decade and a half. And David exited the business about 5 years ago now. And so it's kind of like where we are now.
Success story.
Yeah, I feel successful at it. Yeah. Gotcha.
How many of
James? The James Beard thing, that's a good sign. He was the James Beard semifinalist.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And I noticed that the shelves got empty a lot earlier. I got there shortly after it was announced, and I remember walking in. I thought you were going to close. There was nothing on the shelves, nothing. I think, I'll take it back. There was one baguette, and it was only 10 in the morning. And yeah. I don't know what I didn't, and there was no pastry, and there were like three cookies, and I thought, what's going on? And they said, oh yeah, people were here, and I said, okay. I actually want to ask about a product because I recently started getting the miche, and I really like it, and in part because it lasts so long.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it that makes it such a lasting product?
Sorry.
Sorry, the miche.
Well, maybe you can describe it to him.
Oh, it's a huge loaf, and you can buy it in a half of it, which is still huge.
A bowl.
And no, it's not a bowl. It's a large loaf. When I say it's this big, I'm not kidding. It's this big. And you can get it sliced. And I usually get half, and it will easily last a week. And it's interesting to me because other loaves don't necessarily last, or if they last, they tend to get drier.
Yeah.
And so what is it about the meat that makes it keep so well?
Well, there's a couple of things. Some of it's just kind of the dough makeup. There's a decent percentage of rye, and that holds moisture very, really well. But the biggest thing is actually the size. So there's a reason why they're baked large, and it has a much higher crumb to crust ratio. So the crumb being inside of the bread, so the larger that is, the larger the loaf is, the more crumb you'll have, and less crust, or the ratio is different. Whereas a baguette, for example, is a high crust to crumb ratio. And so a baguette sales very quickly.
Is there something about the sourdough itself, though?
That in the niche?
Yeah. Well, sourdough starter, I wonder if it's also...
Yeah, that certainly is another sourdough. It does something different to how the starches hold on to the water, essentially, like, so it kind of helps to delay that staling. And then there's also the acidity that's in sourdoughs can prevent molding for a period of time. So I've had the niche sitting on my counter for 12 days, you know, and it's not molding. I still have one that I baked last Sunday at a class, you know, and it's funny, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of stale.
But it's still toast.
Yes, but the niche in particular, I love it because I years ago I outlined sort of like this diagram, and I called it 5 days of niche. And it was, you know, like what you do with the niche for 5 days, you know, like day one, it's obviously just eat it fresh. And then, you know, day two, it's something else. Day three, it's something else. And, you know, maybe by day five, you're turning it into a completely different product, or drying it more in the oven and making, you know, making like bread dumplings. You know, there's just a whole variety of things. And so, as Ronnie had said, you know, like you would never throw that away, you know. And as I was describing in the passage in that book, it's like those loaves are baked very large, and then, you know, you'd have them for about 2 weeks, and you know, the first day one is probably, oh, this is wonderful. And then by the, you know, day 14, if they're rock hard, but you break it and you pour a broth over it, and there you have it spinning, you know, and it would moisten it up again. So, and like you said, I love that, you know, in the past in France, 900 grams of bread for daily caloric intake for the bread, and now it's 130 grams. Or that's 900 grams of, that's a lot of bread.
A couple of things is just a couple comments is I spent my half of my career mixing clay in a dough mixer. You know, a great thing.
Yeah.
A mixer. And the one thing I really like about good bread, I spent a lot of time in France, and you know, and your bread too, is the hint of salt on the crust. And does it precipitate out? I mean, you know, or it's a little bit more concentrated. It's just really, I mean, it just
that's interesting. Makes I never really thought about it that way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and you know, good breads, you know, you find at a decent bakery in France.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe it's just the quality of the crust.
Really, really good.
Highlights. Yeah.
Right. But speaking of Burgundy, I was in Burgundy a couple years ago visiting some friends and driving by a town, and there was a slot machine or a soda pop machine where people were buying bread because the bakery was no longer there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were like three people in line waiting to buy their bread, which was kind of disgusting.
Out of the vending machine?
Yeah, out of the vending machine.
Yeah.
Right. And then the one more thing is the, and then, you know, in high school when I was there for a while, they had the big, we called them and they were this big. And it was a big rotating disc that you would cut it. And the bakery delivered, I'm not sure if it was once or twice a week, but no more than twice a week. They call wood. So.
That's fun, yeah.
Can you only buy meat in a bakery?
At our bakery, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you can only that we make that you can only get at our store.
And how many? How large is your staff?
We have our company is 50 to 52 employees, which I would include myself and my wife as well. And we've have. Let's see here on the baking staff. I think we have 12 bread bakers, 12 pastry bakers.
Do you have bakers in training that may go off to another bakery, or do you just train them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my goal is obviously to train them how we do it. You know, I've taken on a couple of like interns over the years who have gone on to do their own thing. And they came in with that, you know, I'm going to spend 3 months with you and really try to get myself prepared to own my own bakery, which is great. I'd like to tell people that my, you know, sort of altruistic goal would be to train bakers so that they could go bake anywhere, you know. So I tell people that who want to work for us that, you know, I'm going to give you the skills that you would need to bake at any bakery. So like at the highest quality to the lowest quality, you'd be fine. And some people, you know, they end up baking with us for 3 years, 4 years, and then they don't really bake any longer because the work is challenging. You know, even me, after baking for as an employee of Madison Sourdough for 3.5-4 years, before I even decided I actually wanted to own this place, I actually gave my notice. I gave 5 months notice. I said, I'm going to move. I don't want to bake anymore. And then there's just a lot of things that kind of contributed to the decision to keep doing it. But I think, it's, I don't want to call it burnout, but people tend to be ready to kind of move on. But then there's some that stick with it and some who have gone off and they've baked other places and they've started their own businesses as well, which is really encouraging to see, you know, in different parts of the country or parts of the state. But yeah, the training is it's a really important, it's so important to the whole operation. You know, like I can give a talk of like now, mm-hmm. We'll talk about how, you know, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. I can't be there every single day, you know. So my goal as an operator is to, you know, I love doing it. When I've realized that I've taken a back seat and I've done more just strictly management stuff, and I have to be baking. I cannot, like, it's not that I have to do it as a person. I just, if I'm going to be there, I don't want to be in an office. I want to be baking. Like it's the only thing I want to do while I'm there. So, but the train, you know, we have a whole team of people, you know, that are, you know, trying to get everyone to be on the same page and pulling in the same direction and really caring about the product. And I think that's one of the things that defines us as, you know, a good bakery is that the people who work at Madison Sourdough really do care about the product and care about the service and all that stuff. So,
and then I just, you just reminded me when you were talking about liking the white bread when you were a kid, getting the white bread. And my dad always insisted that we have Roman meal bread. Now, I don't even And my grandma Schindler, who had probably baked her own bread for many years, by this time was buying Wonder Bread. And all we kids thought it was so wonderful. White bread at Christmas.
Well, I was hoping you'd speak a little bit about the sourdough itself and people's relationship to it, which really is fairly reverential, I think, and just the resilience of it. Because, you know, stories where people have left it in their fridge and then a few years later they find it and revive it. But then there's also on the other end, there's a hotel in San Francisco. It's the Sourdough Hotel, where if you have to go on vacation, you park your sourdough so they can keep it.
It's right next to the dog kennel.
Yeah, I've heard described recently as a low maintenance pet. Feed it once a week. For me, you know, on the professional side, we're with it every day, you know, and so we are really in tune with it. But I mean, I love the way home bakers get very, you know, I don't think that the, I've always have had a very, I don't know, like even just in my first year of baking, I felt really, at that time I was working 6 days a week. And so I only have one day off. And it was like, I was really like in tune with that process. I think with our bakers now in the professional setting, it's, they kind of understand it, but they're not, you know, I don't wish they'd ask more questions, you know, like what they're dealing with. But I think that the home baker, it just, like you said, it does become very reverential, right? And it becomes this thing that, you know, like I said, people name it and they, you know, they share it, you know, and it's just sort of like endless sort of propagation that can happen, which is kind of fun. So, yeah.
Dave?
Yeah.
No, just management, guys. You know, you got to. Good market share. I'm sure, Drew, you're the owner, chief baker, and I assume CEO, but who does the financial planning, some kind of strategy, HR, the other functions of management? How have you delegated that, or have you?
Yeah, so my business partner, David, who is now has exited the business, he was the person who was doing the majority of that. When he was here, when he left, my wife Emma kind of stepped into a role, and she's really, I mean, it's just, I feel so lucky to have someone as smart and talented as her to kind of sink into it. And we call her our creative director, because she's also we met in art school, and she does a lot of design, but she is like a Renaissance person, just very like, she can do anything. She'll do maintenance. She'll put up artwork, and she'll also do the financial side of things. So she is, as this year in particular, has really graduated to, I wouldn't say she's graduated to more of like a CFO kind of role. Mm-hmm. And then she shares HR duties with another person, Caitlin, who's been with us for 12 years. And she started as a baker. And she was managing the bakery for a couple of years. And she kind of reached a point where she just didn't really want to do the early mornings anymore. She really liked working for the company and just kind of said, hey, if there's ever an opportunity for something else, I'd really like to stay here. And within that year, one of our main office people was going to be retiring. And so Caitlin stepped into that role, and, you know, between the two of them, I mean, I say almost everyone's replaceable to some degree, right? Realistically, but it's hard for me to imagine. They've they really got the hold. I feel very confident in it. So
turnover.
Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad.
But I mean, the rotation or turnover isn't great, I assume.
It's a weird time period. For us, we went through a period of time where we had almost 0% of turnover, especially during the 3 years or so of the pandemic. That was, and then kind of when we came out of that, we had a very high turnover, and now we're kind of starting to get a little bit more solid group of people that are, you know, going to be around for, I expect people to, if I'm going to train them, I tell them, give me a year at least, you know. Usually people stay for somewhere between 1 and 5 years typically.
Any other question?
Comment quick and then specific baking question. I found recipes to use the discard sourdough, and sourdough waffles is one of them that you ferment overnight, and it's the best waffle I've ever had. So look for recipes on how you use this kind, because there's a lot of it if you bake regularly. I will make loaves of bread that are nice and fluffy and beautiful, and then I'll make, like yesterday I made hamburger buns for the first time, and they just didn't rise. The second rise just never really. And I have it happen with bread as well, and it just frustrates the hell out of me. So what? Why? What? What's it? Tell me how to prove it. And I don't understand how weather really impacts in a commercial bakery, because you're air conditioned, and I don't understand why that would matter. But
I don't either. But it does. It's just, it's like, it takes. We joke around. It takes. It's like after 2 days, the weather finds its way into the bakery. It's like, okay. Yeah, there's a little lag time, and then eventually it's like, oh, okay, yeah, it's hot out.
Crazy.
It is strange. I don't know how to, without a lot of specifics, I can't.
Okay.
I can't.
I mean, you're saying recipe multiple times, and sometimes you don't get a rise very well, and it just.
I'm like, sometimes you do.
Yeah, I'd say the main thing is just temperature control of the dough itself. That's the main, like, if your temperature of the dough is outside a certain range, then it's going to be slow or really fast, very warm. But most likely this time you're very slow.
So you're better slow than fast? Like, I have a proof setting in my oven that's 85 degrees. Is that?
Yeah.
A good thing or a bad thing to proof at 85 degrees?
That's pretty warm. Yeah, it's a little bit warm.
Any other questions?
Just a very quick one. Back when you were working all the time and you didn't have other people working for you, what was your actual daily schedule, and how in the world did you sleep? Did you break it into two things? Did you sleep until, you know, 2 o'clock, and then when that was over, you came home and slept through the day like a vampire.
I kind of made it work, but I guess I would, on a normal schedule, I would probably, like in my 20s, I would say, before I had kids, I would typically sleep at night for about 6 hours, and then I would take like a 2 hour nap after work.
Okay.
Well, that's kind of how that would generally shake out.
I'm saying with no other factors, just through you and the brick.
Yeah. And it was it was different. And then when I had kids, I didn't like sleep at all.
You don't have to be a baker to do that.
But, we were just balancing. My wife, Emma, was a school teacher. And then, you know, there was just all kinds of, like, there were days where I would go in at like 1 a.m. and I would work until 6:30, and then I would go home and get the baby. And then she would go to work. And me and Juniper, my firstborn, we're like just total snuggle buddies, because I think it's because I necessarily, we adapted our, we became nap, you know, nap at the same time and we'd be together. And I really look back on it as all kind of a daze, you know, because I wasn't sleeping well. But over the years, when I tell people this, who starts baking, is that this sleep is everything. And as I get older, I realize how important that is. I definitely did some damage to myself not sleeping enough for like years. And it's just, it is very important to just health, mental health, physical health. And so like just this weekend, I had this really wacky kind of turnaround where I was up late, getting up early and doing this. And it's just like, every time I do something like that, I just, you know, at this point in my life, I feel in the same spot in my back where I'm just like, I didn't sleep enough. And I've been on my feet, you know, and I just can really feel it. I know how to resolve it. You know, I need to sleep, you know? But yeah, I try to emphasize that to people. And it's a really, honestly, a deeper conversation that I have with some of my upper level management, which is, you know, the thing about bakers getting up early is so that we can make fresh bread for you all. And so the question that I always ask is like, well, what if we just baked in the middle of the day and sold it the next day? You know, well, it wouldn't be as good, you know? And so, but at what expense? What are we giving up? You know, what kind of damage are we doing? You know, and so yeah, we debate that kind of thing, you know, internally, just to, okay, well, what would make this, like when we talk about turnover, you know, obviously getting up really early in the morning is it's a hard to draw people into that lifestyle, you know. So yeah.
All right.
Okay. One more question. I think
great question. We had a blast up.
So we have to come to your shop to get the miche. Where do you distribute in this area? Where can we find another product from you?
Yeah. So,
where do you live?
Yeah. Well, I happen to be near Hilldale, so we can talk about Metcalf's. But do you distribute to grocery stores?
Yeah. So, the grocery stores, Metcalf's in Hilldale, Metcalf's on the west side, all three Lily Street co-ops, Region Street co-op, Jenny Street Market,
good.
Festival Foods, Woodman's, East and West. And then, yeah, then there's the Farmer's Market, the West Side Community Market, over on Research Drive.
Where you sell meat.
We sell them there.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.